Welcome to today's episode of Public Anthropologist podcast series. Here we feature ideas and thoughts about issues that concern the public. Researchers are encouraged to translate complex social idea or theory into intelligible language, which is grounded in empirical research. I'm your co-host, Soumya Pandey, a doctoral researcher at Christian Michelsen Institute in Norway. On today's episode, I will be speaking with anthropologist Mark Goodale, professor of cultural and social anthropology and director of the Laboratory of Cultural and Social Anthropology at the University of Lausanne in Switzerland. Goodale has extensively written on the history of humanitarianism, international aid, and the role that anthropology as a discipline has played in it. His ongoing four-year research project on lithium industrialization and resource politics in Bolivia focuses on the political economies of the green energy transition debate. Today, we will be speaking about his most recent book titled Reinventing Human Rights, in which he asks if a distinction at all can be drawn between the ideas of politics, economy, and human rights. Hi, Professor Mark Goodale. Thank you so much for coming on this podcast. I'm quite curious about your work on human rights. If you could share a little about how did you get interested in this topic?
Well, first of all, Soumya, thank you for inviting me to this podcast. I'm very much appreciate the effort to translate our work into broader terms. So I got interested in human rights somewhat by accident. It happened through my doctoral research, which I did in the late 1990s in a small village and rural area of Bolivia. So I had gone down to Bolivia to study conflict resolution, how indigenous villagers resolved their disputes outside of the boundaries of the state court system. That was the project that I had proposed for my doctoral research. And when I arrived, I was prepared to do that, and yet when I walked and traveled from small community to small community, what I found was that many of the communities had been visited by and were working with transnational human rights non-governmental organizations, NGOs, most of them from Northern Europe, actually Spain, and then the Nordic countries, a few American NGOs. Very few actually Bolivian NGOs. And this was happening within 10 years of the end of the Cold War, which meant that this was this first era of what Kofi Annan, the Secretary General of the United Nations, described at one point as the age of human rights. So this is a sort of golden age of human rights activism, which was the first 10 years, basically from the end of the Cold War until September 2001. In which the geopolitical stakes changed quite considerably. So I was there during this sort of golden age of human rights activism. And so on the one hand, I wanted to study how, I continued to study how indigenous Bolivian villagers were resolving their disputes within their own systems. But those systems were in the process of being changed through their interaction with human rights NGOs. So I modified my project to take account of the impact of that human rights activism on dispute resolution in small villages. And so that's what I did. And that led me to start thinking more generally about human rights activism. When did that start? Where did it come from? And what were the larger consequences of human rights activism and the age of human rights more generally? And that took me into discussions beyond anthropology, because a lot of people were thinking about what was this new world we were living in, this so-called age of human rights. And that was one question led to the next, and that continued for many years. And it was a series of interests that I followed through a number of different activities, including publications, but not only. So that's more or less the story of how I got interested in human rights.
You've spoken about the idea of morality, and you discussed that in quite detail. And I was wondering if you could help our listeners understand why is the legacy of human rights a moral project? Mm-hmm. And what is the history of this moral project in the context of the United Nations?
So, I mean, I think one of the things to keep in mind is to understand the emergence of what we might call the modern human rights project, the modern human rights system. This begins not on December 10th, 1948, when the General Assembly adopted or ratified the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. But it began before, but not too long before, because again, human rights is always in relation to larger geopolitical, economic developments. And so, of course, you can go back and into the late 18th century and think about how what we talk about as human rights began, had their life in the rights-based revolutions of the late 18th century, the French Revolution, the Declaration of Independence. And then in the early 19th century, you have the Latin American revolutions, which are inspired by the French Revolution and the American Revolution. And why is that important? Because those revolutions were very much the attempt to put into practice a set of ideas about the so-called rights of man or natural rights, which were being developed before the late 18th century by social contract theorists like Jean-Jacques Rousseau, and before him, Thomas Hobbes. And then most importantly for the United States, for example, would be John Locke. But anyway, you have these social contract theorists who said that, human beings, of course, human beings had a different meaning back then. It wasn't all human beings. It wasn't even women. It was the category of human being was much more limited. But the idea was that human beings shouldn't be subjects to a sovereign or subjects to some kind of divine ruler on earth. But we are, in fact, citizens should be citizens because we are defined by bundles of rights which are given to us just by virtue of being human beings. This is the notion of natural rights, that human beings are born with rights, the right to ex which are entitlements. We're entitled to expect certain things. We're entitled to expect certain things won't be done to us, like our lives will be taken away just for no reason, or that our liberty will be restrained, or we'll be able to speak within certain limits. These are this notion of rights. And this idea that we are in a way a bundle of natural rights was an idea that emerged in a particular place and time through a particular history, and then that then kind of evolves through the centuries. But when we get to by the time we get to the end of World War II, it's important to keep in mind that the world had just come through to a cycle of two of the most fearsome, most destructive wars in human history, World War I and World War II. And even after World War I, there was an idea of trying to use rights in some way to protect the world against another war. But that didn't work. So by the time we got to World War II, we'd have tens, if not hundreds of millions of people killed. We have some of the worst crimes ever committed against human populations. And so the intellectual political leaders who were responsible for, in a way, proposing what comes next, many of them, or some of them, saw that crisis of the last 50 years as a moral crisis. In other words, there were political consequences. States were invading other states. They were committing genocide. There was militarism. There was all of that was what is called in German Realpolitik. It was the politics of reality. It was national interest. But for intellectuals and theologians and others, they said, well, why are states acting like that? Why are they invading other states? Why are they committing genocide? Because there's actually at the base a moral failure. It's a failure to recognize that other people are just like we are, that we're all essentially the same. That is, that we all are bundles of rights, that we all are equal in the fact that we all have human rights. And in the Charter of the United Nations and in the preamble of the Universal Declaration, you see very clearly that they foreground the declaration, they foreground what comes next as a moral project, as a way of responding to a moral crisis with a moral solution. So the human rights is in a way a kind of moral solution to this crisis, this moral failure. And so I think it's important to understand that in at its heart, the human rights was at the beginning a moral project, which was then supposed to have political consequences, political forms. If the wars before were the political consequences of a moral problem, then if we solve that moral problem, then there should be better political consequences, states not invading each other, states respecting each other. And you see very clearly when you look at Eleanor Roosevelt, for example, who was the chair of the Commission on Human Rights, who was the former First Lady of the United States. She gave an interview in 1948, a few months before this is when the Declaration was pretty much finished. And she gave an interview for Foreign Affairs magazine in which she acknowledges that we on the commission really don't have any expectation that at the moment that the Universal Declaration is adopted, it's going to change politically, that everything is going to change politically. Because what was happening at the same time was the Cold War was beginning. The lines of division were starting to open up between the Soviet Union, France, the victors who are part of the Permanent Security Council, who played an important role in the founding of the United Nations, already by 1948 were starting to show divisions. And in fact, the Cold War would start 1 year. I mean, we can start it from 1949. There's the Berlin Airlift, and the wall goes up in Berlin, and suddenly these countries, which had fought together during World War II, become enemies because the Soviet Union is following a radically different model for economic and social development, and the capitalist countries of the West are following a different so the warning signs of the Cold War were already there in 1948 when they were trying to figure out work together, and they barely got the Universal Declaration put together. But in this interview, Eleanor Roosevelt says, and I'm paraphrasing, she says, we on the commission don't have really any hope that this is going to become a reality, that the states, it's going to change the course of politics. But she says, we're going to have to wait maybe even many decades before states start to be shaped by this idea of human rights. And she talked about it. She didn't use the word moral project, but very interestingly, she said that for me, I see human rights as largely an educational project. It's an educate, which I think is a synonym for moral project in the sense that it's education is the vehicle through which different ethics or moral projects are taught. So she said that with enough education, people will come to see themselves as equal in rights, and therefore will demand of their states to act in that way. So I think that's the history. And then when we get to the end of the Cold War, what was again interesting is that, and we can talk about what happened during the Cold War. Maybe I think some of your questions or some of our discussion might touch on that. But in fact, that's what happened is that although there was more political substance, if we go back to my story about Bolivia, the way in which derechos humanos, human rights, was being presented to indigenous Bolivians was not so much as a tool that they could use to go off immediately to La Paz and demand changes from the government. It was in fact being presented as a moral project. Derechos humanos, the idea that we are all the same, that you, indigenous Bolivian villagers in a remote part of the country who are completely forgotten by the state, you are actually the same. You are actually equal as any other Bolivian, as any other person in the world. And although people don't believe that, and although people don't treat you like that, that is the truth. So it was a moral project. It was being presented as a moral project. And we anthropologists who found ourselves in a similar situation in the 1990s, doing research and then observing this human rights activism, if you look at the literature in the anthropology of human rights that was published in the 2000s, which was analyzing projects from the 1990s, you see a similar story playing out in many parts of Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in the places where human rights activism was strongest. It was really being developed as a moral project. So that essence of human rights, which was there in 1948, continues through the decades.
I was meaning to come to that. I wanted to understand how did anthropology respond to this sudden upsurge of this co-opting of human rights language in social and political class? And if you could explain this in the context of your own research on how was American anthropology, for example, responding to this new language of human rights?
So, that's a question which, so there's a, you asked me why I got interested in human rights, and I was explaining that the interest sort of led to through different kinds of projects, and one of them was much more of a historical project, was trying to recover and understand the relationship of anthropologists and anthropology in general to this moral project of human rights. And it's a history that starts before the Declaration of Independence. It starts with actually one anthropologist, an American anthropologist called Melville Herskovitz, who started African studies in the United States at Northwestern University and was an anthropologist who did research in Africa, but also was very much involved with the American Anthropological Association. And in 1947, a specialized agency of the United Nations called UNESCO, which had just been created in January of 1947, and whose general secretary, general director, Julian Huxley, had the idea to participate along with the Commission on Human Rights, but parallel to the Commission on Human Rights, which, as I just said, was being directed by Eleanor Roosevelt and was largely based in the United States. And so Julian Huxley, who was the head of UNESCO and which was based in Paris, decided to participate by sending a questionnaire, like a survey, out to an amazing array of people around the world, asking them what they think about this project, this idea of human rights, which the UN had already announced that we are going to work toward a new Bill of Rights, a declaration. It had different names. You know, it had the International Bill of Rights, and eventually it became the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. I mean, it was, for example, when they first started, it was the International Declaration of the Rights of Man. And so there was actually a debate about whether it's human or men, and that's another hit, another story. But so this interesting survey took place over about a year and a half, and it was completed before the declaration was finalized. And this questionnaire was sent out to an amazing array of people, including Mahatma Gandhi got a request, and actually wasn't able to respond. He did write a letter which contained some interesting a few lines about what he thought about human rights, which are interesting, but he didn't respond. But a lot of people did write formal essays. They wrote responses, which took the form of 1, 2, 3-page essays. And one of the people who wrote that a response, or was asked to write a response, was Melville Herskovitz. And in fact, there were two anthropologists among the roughly 70 people who received the survey, one of whom was an Australian anthropologist called A.P. Elkin. But the more interesting one was the response of Melville Herskovitz. And his response, which was not produced in an official capacity, but was written in a personal capacity, but which later then was taken as a kind of semi-official view of anthropology at the time, in part because there has been a mistaken belief that it was an official statement. And it's understandable why that was a mistake, because the response itself was published in American Anthropologist, one of the leading journals in the United States. And there's a little note at the top that says, sent by the Executive Committee of the American Anthropological Association to the Commission on Human Rights, which was wrong. That actually didn't happen. There was communication between the Executive Committee and Herskovitz, but Herskovitz sent his response directly to UNESCO. So it really didn't go through the American Anthropological Association. And more importantly, the members of the American Anthropological Association didn't vote on it, as it wasn't a kind of an official statement. But anyway, leaving that aside, the statement itself was extremely critical of the idea of human rights. And it had different lines of criticism. For example, there's an empirical criticism, which is that anthropological research reveals diversity in legal systems and ethical systems, and it doesn't reveal a kind of universal consensus, universal human rights. You couldn't use that diversity to sort of derive the kinds of articles that they were working on at the time. And there was also an ethical part of his critique, which was that no matter what the good intentions of the United Nations are, at the moment that this becomes an official document, it will be associated with the United Nations. And the United Nations, even at the time, was very much controlled by the Security Council, by the dominant countries of the world. And it was being produced in a world that was largely colonial at the time. You have to remember, 1948 is at the time where the Indian partition is happening. Most of Africa is still under colonial rule. Much of Asia is still under East Asia, and Southeast Asia is under colonial rule. So you have like 46 countries in the United Nations, not 190 or whatever it is today. So most of the world wasn't even represented in the United Nations. But nevertheless, this small United Nations was being dominated by countries like the United States, like the Soviet Union, like the Republic of China, which would very quickly become the People's Republic of China, like France, the countries of the permanent seats of the Security Council. So that became basically the and so this is this statement is sent to UNESCO. It's published in American Anthropologist. 1 year later, you have a little bit of pe some people wrote like letters to the editor in response to this statement, which was published. But after that, from roughly 1949 all the way until the 1980s, you have nothing. It's just utter silence. So human rights is not only not a subject of interest for anthropologists, but in a way, it's not a subject that, of interest. It's not a framework of importance for the world itself. It doesn't mean that there aren't things going on. I mean, you have debates around the international covenants. International lawyers are working on human rights. Every once in a while, someone will mention human rights. Nelson Mandela, when he was being sentenced to life in prison, he mentions human rights, not as a central thread, but he mentions human rights in his speech before being sentenced to life in prison. Václav Havel, as a member of the Charter 77 movement, who kind of represents the dissidents in the Soviet bloc, he talks about human rights as one of the reasons why the Soviet style repression of free speech is wrong. But in terms of actually affecting geopolitics throughout the entire Cold War, there's very limited impact. So the absence of that interest in anthropology is a mirror of the absence of importance of human rights in the world. Because what you see when you look at anthropologists is our projects tend to mirror what is important in the world itself. We tend to respond to, we don't propose projects interest which then become important in the world at large. I mean, anthropology itself is largely a social scientific mirror, and our interests are changing, hopefully, and responding to what's important in the world. So I think that explains a little bit of the history, and the reason why the anthropology of human rights, with which I'm associated, and a few others, did emerge. Because, as I said, after the end of the Cold War, the logic changed completely. Once that geopolitical bipolar logic with a non-aligned world, once that bipolar logic kind of disappeared, there's a vacuum. And so suddenly this moral project, which had been developed and proposed in the late 1940s, could suddenly then emerge and flower. And so you have an explosion of human rights activism. Again, coming back to what Kofi Annan, he's not an anthropologist, he's the head of the UN. The age of human rights, the sort of golden age, which is roughly 1990 to 2001. So anthropologists like myself are out there, and if anthropology is a mirror, then we responded. The anthropology of human rights only became possible as a reflection of this kind of explosion and emergence of human rights in its various forms. And you could follow that through to the present, in the sense that the golden age of human rights ended, and then the place of human rights, it's a sort of parabolic arc, of importance. And so then human rights started to decline, and other logics emerge. The national security state comes back after September 11th, and you start to have the surveillance state, and human rights activism starts changing and becoming less important at the same time that the system of neoliberal capitalism is becoming consolidated. And then you have China becoming as much a capitalist power as the United States, which we can talk about the economic thing in a little bit. So the anthropology of human rights itself is changing and reflecting the life of human rights in the post-Cold, what I call the post-Cold War, after the end of after the end of the Cold War, which has its own little its own eras, until when we come today, you know, it's a question whether the anthropology of human rights is actually viable. If anthropology reflects what's important in the world, and human rights has ceased to become an important logic or moral project in the way it was, then it's a question of what's the place for an anthropology of human rights.
We have come a long way, and now we have local NGOs, and there are collaborations with international NGOs. There's this whole circulation of capital. And I was wondering if you could perhaps share a little about how has the current economic system, which as we see is based on so much of privatization, extraction, and free market, like a sort of capitalist system, shaped the understanding of human rights in the present?
So I think the question of the relationship of what we might call political economy to human rights is absolutely critical. And the reason why I use political economy and not just economic system is because, in a way, the old idea that politics and economics are intertwined remains as important as ever. So it's important not to draw a distinction between politics and economics here. And I think that that's become particularly clear, again, coming back to this important turning point of the end of the Cold War, in the sense that the global political system, the UN system, has become increasingly co-opted by powerful economic actors, to the point to which as I've argued in Reinventing Human Rights, in my recent book on human rights, in my last chapter, I describe our world, again, for very general purposes, as a G20 world. And I make the argument that the group of 20, this elite club of economic actors, is really the center of global power. It's not the United Nations. And really, it never was the United Nations, but there was always the hope that this moral political project of the post-war world would eventually come to control global affairs, would prevent conflict, and this dream of, you know, Kant talked about the dream of a cosmopolitan world, that this cosmopolitan world of global citizenship and global belonging would eventually come to pass. But that didn't happen. And if we need any more concrete evidence, just look what happened during the recent global COVID-19 pandemic. Where was that global world when we needed to organize our response as a collective, as a globe? I mean, what better threat, what better menace to our collective interests than a global pandemic, which doesn't respect borders and which affects everybody in the world? And yet our response was completely haphazard. Some rich countries were able to hoard the vaccines, and others had to negotiate. And even within countries, there was a lack of a unified response. If you look at the United States, for example, one of the world's largest economy, one of the world's most important countries, you have to analyze it state by state, city by city. There was a complete failure of the United Nations to meet its obligation, which was to be the entity which would help us deal with global conflicts, whether wars or pandemics. So we can pretty much kind of put aside the idea that post-war dream of internationalism can be kept alive. I think by the time we get to the deep into the mature post-Cold War, and in my book, I identify an important meeting in 2008 of the G20, which took place in Washington, D.C., not surprisingly, under the invitation of George W. Bush. It was after the global financial crisis, right after the global financial crisis. And it was basically the G20, this elite club, getting together and saying, look, we can fight over politics. We can fight over a lot of different things, but we all have one thing in common. We're all absolutely committed to a global capitalist system. Our economies, in one way or another, depend on the functioning of a global market, which is a global capitalist market, financial movement of products, movement of labor. It is a global capitalist system that has pockets of independence, but it is integrated. And the 2007, 2008 crisis, which starts as a housing bubble in one country, and then ramifies financially through banks all around the world, from Iceland to China to Latin America. I mean, it was a globe became a global like a global depression. Again, in a way, the 2007, 2008 financial crisis was similar to the global pandemic, you know, in the sense that this thing begins in one place, a potential crisis, and then ramifies through the system. So the idea, just like with the pandemic in 2007, 2008, there really wasn't a global financial network or entity which could prevent the worst damage. It was really something taking place. And so the idea of the G20 after 2007 was, can we imagine putting in place some kind of system or some kind of club or relationship that we could, that our financial, that our central bankers and the people in our countries who deal with our national banks and our finances, but which are embedded in the global system, can we imagine some strategy so that if something like that took place again, we could prevent it from having that consequence? Notice they didn't do that with the global with the virus, but with when it came to the capitalist system, they at least tried. So this post 2008 development, I call it the G20 world. And it was interesting because in the G20 you have Saudi Arabia, you have a, you know, this is a an Islamic absolute monarchy. You have China, which is still officially a Marxist-Leninist state, so it's still technically Marxist-Leninist. You have representative democracies. I mean, the diversity of countries in the G20 is amazing. What's not diverse is the relationship with the global capitalist system. Some of the countries like China don't privilege the private market. Most of the companies are ultimately state companies or state-driven. You have other countries where, like the United States, where a lot of the capitalist enterprise is private. And then you have, you know, hybrid models. But that doesn't change. It doesn't change the fact that you have state companies, Chinese companies, which are in Bolivia, for example, participating in the lithium industrialization project, which is what I'm studying now. That doesn't change because, again, that the lithium that's produced through a state-run process still goes into the global market. It's still used to make lithium-ion batteries, which are used to make electric vehicles. That's all taking place within a capitalist system. So the point of that is to understand what is the place of human rights in that system. And the answer that I give is human rights is has a place within the G20 world only to the extent to which it's human rights itself can be financialized in some kind of way. How does human rights, and on a more negative sense, that human rights doesn't become, or human rights don't become an obstacle to the economic interests that are part of this G20 world. So in other work, I've tracked the way in which rights, indigenous rights, social and economic rights, other kinds of rights, both at the international level and in national levels, are absorbed by this political economic system, are used as tools. You know, to give you an example, think of the whole corporate good governance system which has emerged, which is something which is relatively new in this history. So this idea that corporations have started to take it as put as part of their planning various activities which are often mostly symbolic, which make a gesture toward human rights. You know, our plant, you know, I know you talked to Tanya Lee, you know, our so just to use the example of palm oil, our palm oil plantations in Indonesia are organized to respect the rights of our workers and to respect the rights, the environmental situation, et cetera. So there's a lot of discourse. There's it's all of that. It's expected by shareholders and so on. But if you look in practice, what are the practical impacts of this corporate good governance on the actual realization of rights of Indonesian workers or on the actual protection of orangutan habitat? It's minimal. And in fact, you could even go further and say that some of the damage, some of the land grabbing has actually increased at to the extent to at the same time that human rights and corporate good governance has been put into plans. Why? Because if a company can say, look, officially we're certified as a company that respects human rights according to some industry standard, that gives them cover to actually be more destructive, more extractive, more, to be more harmful economically, because they can say, well, I don't know what you're saying. I don't, your criticism doesn't have any validity. We're certified as a gold star palm oil producer by the International Palm Oil Association, So I think that I guess I understand, I realize it's a somewhat pessimistic image, but that's my more or less how I think about the relationship between political economy and human rights in the world today. And of course, there are others that are writing about this. I'm sure your listeners might have heard of Samuel Moyn's work, who's written about the history of, he's a historian of human rights, a so-called new historian of human rights. So he's part of a group of historians who are reinterpreting the history of human rights. And one of his latest books on in this area is called Not Enough, in which he analyzes with very open eyes the fact that even in the best case scenario, human rights are not a tool for preventing political economic harm. And but of course, we don't live in a world of best case scenario. We live in the world of reality. But he says, even if we imagine as a thought experiment what it would be like if all countries adopted the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, that was part of the legal, including the United States, if that was part of the legal system of all countries in the world, that would still not be nearly enough to have a real impact on the kind of changes, including climate change, which can be associated with capitalism as a political economy.
Brings me to my next question. You have somewhere said in your book, quoting you, economic and social rights have proven to be a mirage. And I was wondering if you could help me understand that with a more contemporary example.
Well, so in the book, I use I use the somewhat unusual example of the national human rights institutions to kind of explain in practice why I think that economic and social rights are a mirage. But before I get to the practical example, just to explain what I mean by that, which is related to what I was just mentioning about Samuel Moyn, whose analysis I largely agree with. And to Moyn's analysis, we should also add the more recent work of an Australian philosopher called Jessica White, who wrote a book called Morals of the Market. Because in Samuel Moyn's book, he talks about the fact, he leaves the question of whether or not the intimate relationship between human rights and capitalism was intentional or was a kind of coincidence that political economic actors just found out they could take advantage of human rights, that human rights in the end wasn't a real tool, an obstacle, that in fact it could be incorporated. Moyn, in his book Not Enough, leaves that question somewhat unanswered. Jessica White, however, in her book, which is also a history, she goes back and looks at the pre-war period through the Declaration of Human Rights as well, and shows that no, in fact, the linkages was very intentional, and she uncovers interesting discussions between corporate actors and people involved with the creation of the modern human rights system, and shows how the idea that the global capitalist market would have a moral structure that itself is grounded in rights, indeed human rights. And that's an argument which is on the one hand surprising, but on the other hand isn't surprising, because if you go back and think about John Locke, for example, who I already mentioned, one of the most important rights that John Locke articulates is the right to property and the right to private property. And the human right, the natural human right to private property, which is an important right for Locke in the way it isn't, for example, Rousseau, which is why it was John Locke who is the natural rights theorist who most influenced the Declaration of Independence, and not the French philosopher Rousseau, who had a much kind of a more complicated notion about rights that was more collectivist, more social. He talked about the common the common will and the common good and so on. Locke very much said, has this anecdote where Locke talks about this, he imagines what would have happened. It's, of course, it didn't happen in reality, but if this is part of the social contract, the state of nature. At one point there was a man, and that man put a barrier around a piece of nature and said, this is mine. You know, this idea that at one point there was a piece of land that there was a human being working with that land and converting nature into something that didn't exist before. And what was converted, the person has a human right to that thing. That notion in Locke, that was there in Locke, becomes an important part of it. And that notion of a right to property then gets carried forward throughout the centuries. I mean, the emergence of capitalism itself is made possible through the right of contract, which might not be seen necessarily as a human right, but it is a kind of extension of the right, the human right to property. Because if you have the human right to property, then you should have a right to negotiate what you do with that property. You want to give it to somebody, you want to sell that to somebody, you want to acquire new property in which you, in a way, their human right to that property gets transferred to you. So you can see how contract itself, this right, this commercial right, is an extension of this Lockean notion of property. And again, I'm an anthropologist, not a legal historian, so I can't talk about how similar processes are taking place around the world with their diverse legal systems. But so in a way, that notion of the right to property then getting expressed through the right to contract is what is the engine which makes the rise of capitalism and industry possible. Without contract rights, capitalism doesn't have any foundation. So the point is that when that system, which is itself based in contract and therefore ultimately the right to own private property, becomes the dominant system globally, then you can see how the moral that rights and human rights become the morals of the market, as Jessica White says, even for China. So in China, okay, China doesn't has its totally different legal and philosophical history, but to the extent to which you have state Chinese companies negotiating contracts in a global system, they are in a way being forced to participate in that system in which the morals of that market are human rights, are the morals of that market, even if internally in China and other kinds of ways, human rights play very little role. So what I mean by mirage, to come back to the question about the mirage, is that economic and social rights are a category of rights which are anchored in an international legal and political system, which requires states to adopt. First of all, the state has the freedom to adopt rights or not. The state adopts the rights, let's say the International Covenant on Economic, Civil, and Cultural Rights. Economic, cultural, and social rights. So the state adopts the rights and then has to implement them in practice. So the reason why I call that a mirage is that, and here again I come back to Samuel Moyn, is that even in countries which have adopted this covenant, that the realization in practice is very tenuous. And so you have, and again, it depends. I mean, if we look at a country like Norway, which is a member, is a signatory to the International Covenant, and which does have a robust social security system and all of that, then the analysis is somewhat different. Then you'd say, well, the gap between the legal recognition of the rights and the realization in practice is much smaller. But the point is that on a global level, because in the end, that's what it is that the ratification of that of economic and cultural, economic, social, and cultural rights does not guarantee their realization in practice. The idea that people will have equality, people will have economic, social security. there's very little correspondence because you have how many members of the covenant. And if you look at what happens internally, there's almost, there's a lot of inequality. Many of the countries that have recognized and adopted the covenant nevertheless have the total absence of economic, the total absence of cultural and social rights in practice. So that shows that there's no sure impact. And so in that way, I call it a mirage. It's a thing that sits in that is out there in front of you, like in the desert. And the closer you think you're getting to it, the farther it keeps going away. So it's like utopia. It's a thing out there that we don't get any closer to, no matter what we do. Again, with some exceptions, some countries, and you can argue that a country like Denmark, which is the country I analyze in my book, their lived reality inside of Denmark looks closer to what that utopia is, but not because they ratified the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, but because in Denmark, as in other Scandinavian countries, there is an alternative system, a parallel system, another morality that is not derived from rights, but is derived from other you might call them cultural bases. So in the book, I talk about the principle of Janteloven, which is a principle of sort of egalitarianism. It's an idea of looking after others, which is important, and not just the law of Janta, I think it is, although of course I don't speak Danish, but I do analyze this in the book. And it's the notion that our society should look after people. People have an obligation to contribute to society, and society has an obligation to look after other people. And apparently that has implications for things like it's frowned upon to boast about your children, to try to separate yourself from others in your community, to say, I'm better than you, we have more than you. People are we're better. That there is the idea that that's frowned upon because that works against this other morality, this other ethics of Janteloven. But right, what are rights? Human rights are a way of saying you yourself as an individual are this bundle of entitlements, and that gives you the capacity to make a claim as an individual, not as a community, but to make a claim on the state. So as I write about in the book, in that chapter, in the last chapter, there's actually anthropological research on the fact that Danish in Denmark, because that's the case study I analyzed, are very suspicious historically of human rights for themselves. As a matter of foreign policy, the Danes have been extremely active in promoting human rights around the world. But as I say in the book, and very controversially, and the Danes who read this don't like this, but this is what it's not my words, but it comes from another study I was using, that the Danes see themselves as too good for human rights, that their society is organized around an ethics which are superior to human rights, which privilege the collective and the society and don't lead to conflict, which is what you get with rights. You have to make demands. So that's what I mean by mirage. The idea, and there I'm in a way just giving a different phrasing to what Samuel Moyne says, that human rights are not enough, that even economic, social, and cultural rights are not enough, that they're not enough to ensure a world of equality, of economic and social equality. And in that sense, we're in a way wasting our time by putting too much effort into seeking to have states like the United States, which, by the way, is not a member of the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. The United States they signed it, but they never ratified that covenant. So the world's largest economy is not a member of the covenant. So if you have a country like the United States, which is not a state party, as they call it, of the International Covenant.
When I was reading this part in your book, I was actually drawing a lot of parallels from here in Norway, and I'm so glad that you mentioned it. And Professor Goodell, finally, I want to ask you, what are the physical and material conditions that make rights in practice a real possibility?
So, just to conclude our conversation, and I very much enjoyed this. I hope I haven't talked too much, but so this brings me in a way to the argument, the central argument of my book, of the recent book, Reinventing Human Rights, which is, given what I've just said, the challenge that I had in the book is there a way to reimagine human rights that avoids many of those problems that I've spent the last hour talking about, the historical linkage with the United Nations, or thinking about Jessica White, the fact that the existing human rights system was co-opted from a very early period by the global economic by the global economic system, or the fact that even in theory, the existing economic and social rights will never be enough to create a world of social and economic equality in practice. So what do we do? Well, there's a lot of there are several different answers to that. One would be that we just sort of acknowledge the reality about human rights, not our dreams of human rights, but the reality of human rights based on the kind of research that we've done, our understanding of history, and say that we need a new framework. There has to be something that replaces human rights. That would be a legitimate argument. That is a legitimate argument. And many people are making that argument, looking for alternatives to human rights in the absence, at the time that human rights becomes the golden age of human rights ends, even from a very early period. And of course, to say that there was a human rights golden age is not to say that those earlier models, like, for example, socialist revolution, or now more of an environmentally based global movement, those were there long before the golden age of human rights and continued. And some of those now themselves have become more important. People are talking about identity-based frameworks for change, Black Lives Matter, racial justice, as in a way replacements for human rights, not as an expression of human rights, but as a replacement for human rights, which wouldn't be subject to the same problems that we've identified with human rights. But what I do in my book is I pose the question, if human rights were to be reinvented or recovered or reimagined, what would that look like? And the book is my attempt to answer that question. And I should emphasize the fact that as an anthropologist, my book is anchored in the writings of others. It's not a book of philosophy. It's a book of anthrop it's not presented as a book of anthropology, but it's grounded in an anthropological methodology. This, I guess, in a way speaks to public anthropology. I see it as an act of public anthropology, a way of showing that an anthropological way of knowing, of methodology, can be the basis for the wider interventions. And in saying that, we have to remember that when I, for example, make re reference to somebody's research as an anthropologist, they themselves, in their research, are giving voice to their interlocutors who don't have the capacity to write books and publish that are read, let's say, in English or in other global languages worldwide. So the Bolivian peasants, the indigenous Bolivians who appear in my books and my research, I cite them. I use their words to make my point. So in a way, anthropology is not just a grounded social science of anthropologists. I hope, in the best of circumstances, that our work is also a vehicle for the voice of others. So in doing this, in proposing this framework for reinventing human rights, what I'm doing is I'm condensing and coalescing anthropological research, which is itself condensing and synthesizing the voices of others, which, to go back to what I was saying about what was going on in 1947 in a largely colonial world in which most of the world did not have a voice in what became the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, I would like to think that a project which seeks to reinvent should be one which does, in its own humble, modest way, give much more voice to a diversity of opinion around the world, in this sense, through anthropology. Now, of course, we can leave aside critiques of ethnography and anthropological research, but that's the ideal. So, just to answer the question more directly, so the idea about what a reinvented human rights would look like, there are two points I would make. One is that given the critique that I make in the book, and which I've summarized here in our conversation, I argue that a reinvented human rights, in whatever form it takes, must be something which is detached from the control of states in particular, detached from the control of the political system, and also detached from the legal system. Because there's a criticism that the juridification, the legalization of human rights, also changed it for the negative, for the worse, I would argue. So basically, what I argue is that a reinvented human rights should be seen not as a new legal framework or a new political framework, but what I call a logic of translocal alliance building and solidarity. So what I mean is that if we are going to talk about human rights and organize around human rights, it is going to be as a logic, as a discourse, a justification that will compel us to act together, but beyond the boundaries that divide us. And those boundaries are multiple. They could be racial boundaries, they could be national boundaries, they could be religious boundaries, they could be class boundaries. But there, what I'm doing is I'm recovering, I'm retaining one key element from that moral project of the Universal Declaration, which was the aspiration that people would come to see themselves as similar, as equal, as sharing common interest. So that's the ambition that I retain. But I use translocality and not universality because I understand through our research that it's very difficult to ask people to think of themselves as humans, ironically. But maybe if these lines of alliance are understood at more, these translocal alliances are understood at more local, regional levels, that's a more realistic project. And so, just to conclude this point by giving you concrete examples, although I don't in the book give examples, I can say, for example, that Extinction Rebellion is an example of a translocal movement, which I would argue expresses the vision for a reinvented human rights, in which people are seeing themselves as sharing an interest, in this case, an interest in preventing climate change and preventing climate catastrophe, and therefore are willing to march and sit in front, of cars in the street, and engage in acts of civil disobedience and actually act together as in solidarity through what I'm calling a reinvented human rights, even though they don't use the language of human rights, which is interesting. But I would say that what they are doing is expressing in practice what I've imagined as reinvented human rights. And I think Black Lives Matter, or the different expressions of move the movement, the global movement, or a global, it's not a global movement, obviously, but that's the aspiration, but it's not in practice. But certainly a translocal movement for racial justice, which is prioritizing racism as a more serious historical problem than people have probably thought, not just the consequences, but actually an originary problem itself, which then gives rise to other problems. I'm conflicted about how to see racism in historical terms, but I think more practically, you can see that the mobilizations that took place around Black Lives Matter, especially in 2020, which then kind of spread across borders, across class, across race, across these lines that normally divide us. I think at the beginning, at least, Black Lives Matter was very much an example of what I'm thinking about with the reinvented human rights. So you can see, and at the same time, Black Lives Matter itself did not really use the language of human rights. And if you look at the literature and the publications of Black Lives Matter, the way in which people talk about it, it's not presented as a human rights movement. It's presented as a movement for racial justice, and those are not the same thing. But it could be a movement which expresses a reinvented human rights. Again, the logic of translocal alliance building grounded in an ethics of solidarity.